and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
But not as much as I love boathouses.
God damn, I love boathouses.
So fucking much.
And I love the things that happen in boathouses.
That's pretty hot.
Welcome to the Sexy Ideas Podcast.
A podcast about two siblings who love boathouses.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Gaz.
And I love boathouses.
And this week...
We read
Maurice by E.M. Forster. And the boathouse thing will become clear more later, I suppose.
It is a reference.
So, as we discussed, I guess technically this will be released in May, but we are recording it in April.
Barely.
So, squeezing in for LGBT month. We finally managed to choose a book that features a gay relationship.
We totally did.
After consciously trying to feature those.
That's right. It was a good week for it. The timely news of Jason Collins coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you haven't heard for some reason, he's an NBA player who came out in a Sports Illustrated article this week.
And I mean, I think that's awesome, because he's the first... professional male athlete to have currently playing,
right,
to have done that.
Right.
But I mentioned to Scott, like, well, half the WNBA is already out, so yeah. How much does it really count?
I felt kind of silly when I was tweeting about it, because I had to qualify it so much. I was like, first athlete, first professional athlete, first North American athlete, in team sports... First male athlete. Oh, God. By the time I was done qualifying, I was almost like, is this even important?
It doesn't even sound impressive anymore. Although, I read the article he wrote about why he came out, and he mentioned the 3 degrees of Jason Collins,
because
he's played on so many teams.
Everybody knows him.
And at the end, he said, a lot of people claim they've never met a gay person, but thanks to the 3 degrees of Jason Collins, everyone in the NBA has. Congratulations. I was like, yeah.
I was actually listening to another podcast this morning with Wesley Morris was the guest. He's a film critic primarily, I guess, but he writes for Grantland, which is primarily a sports site, and he actually had some really good things to say about it, but he said it sounds like, you know, to him the great thing about it was it just sounded like a coming out story.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, so to him it didn't feel quite as much as like a pioneering thing, and he said, and yeah, he's brave, but he's brave in the way thousands of other people have by coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just really liked the almost mundanity of it, I guess.
Yeah, and the fact that it's not going to probably ruin his career or anything.
Yeah, I mean, if anything ruins his career, it's the fact that he's averaged 1.2 points a game last year.
God.
But it sounds like half the league loves the guy. Like, the Celtics practically cried when he got cut.
Oh.
When he got traded or whatever it was, yeah. I mean, it's, from all accounts, a good guy. And
super likable dude.
Clearly a well-spoken person, so. Yeah, that was interesting. So all the people who predicted that would happen in 2013, and many did, are feeling very smart right now.
And even relevant to the book... Jason Collins is coming out and breaking barriers just like E.M. Forster did with Maurice.
Yeah, there you go. There you good. There you go.
There you good. You might have heard of the author before, Forster. The two books he'd written that I recognized because they're talked about is Passage to India and Room with a View. I haven't actually read either one of those books.
Right, and I also recognized Howard's End. I'm thinking maybe it was a movie.
And I don't know.
That's where I've heard the reference.
It's possible. Room with a View has been a movie.
Mm-hmm. But I haven't read or watched that either.
Yeah. Actually, funnily enough, even Maurice has been a movie. But maybe more on that later.
Indeed.
So yeah, Forster wrote this book in 1913. although it wasn't published until 1971.
Yeah, so what's bonkers about that to me is that he wrote this book 100 years ago.
Yep.
Like, almost exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way he dealt with the issue of homosexuality is just stunningly modern at times.
Yeah, it really rang true to me a lot, which I was surprised.
Yeah.
There were a lot of modern feeling moments in it. With the exception of one or two things, like, but it's against the law. Obviously, it's not against the law anymore, but...
Right.
Yeah, and the fact that he wasn't condemning it or anything, which you would just assume anyone writing 100 years ago...
Right.
...is going to be doing that.
But yeah, didn't he say that in the afterword? Like, part of the issue he had publishing it was that it didn't end in tragedy?
Yeah, he made the point that it had to end happy... Because if it had ended tragically, then people would have read it as, oh, they got what they deserved for being gay.
Right.
But he didn't want anyone to read it that way because he didn't think it was a bad thing. So he gave it a happy ending, which was what shocked people.
Right. So...
And which made me go, oh, yeah.
Gabs, by the way, loves the gay.
Maurice and Alex doing it. Whatever. So genre is not gay romance, but actually literary fiction.
Yeah, I mean, it might be the first book we've read that truly fits that genre the way I think of it. But then it's really easy to turn everything into an obscure subgenre. So. But it just seems to fit because it's a book where, and this is probably not fair to the genre of literary fiction, but it's a book where really nothing happens. Features a gay romance, has cultured people, layered conversations, wry observations, good literary technique. Like, the things I think of as literary fiction...
Fair enough, I guess.
Fairly or unfairly, yeah.
Written by an author who writes classics, too.
Right.
So it feels like that.
Right, but not quite old enough for me to say classic.
Right.
And certainly not well-known enough.
No. In fact, I think very few people have heard of this book. It's not really readily available.
Yeah. Hey, Doomsday Book, you're finally going to beat someone.
Maybe. People just click on this because they're like, dudes kissing.
That's true. Who doesn't like that?
Obviously, everyone likes that. We already had that conversation in a previous podcast. What's more manly than two dudes?
Oh, that's right.
Come on. Nothing.
It is the manliest of all activities.
So, plot synopsis.
Two dudes fall in love.
I mean,
literally.
Yeah, that's what happens. Essentially, just to kind of give you a brief overview, the setting is in England in 1912, 1913, right by the time it was written. Centers around a character named Maurice, who, growing up, is just kind of an average kid. He gets to college and meets Clive Durham, and the two of them fall in love and have this chaste, loving relationship for a couple of years, and then Clive decides he likes ladies and is going to go get married, and leaves Maurice all alone, and Maurice decides he needs to stop being an abomination or whatever, and is trying to get cured by a couple doctors, but then meets another dude and decides that he wants to have butt sex instead. Okay, that's not really fair. He decides he's in love. I apologize for being crude.
Yeah, we don't know that there was butt sex.
We actually don't. We know it's not graphic. We just know they make love.
Indeed.
But who knows what that means.
I also like how cavalierly you say an abomination or whatever.
Clearly I should do this professionally.
Books synopsized by Gabs.
Obviously.
Our new website. Check it out next fall.
Like a Tumblr.
Oh, there you go.
So the point of view intense is third person close-ish around mostly Maurice, a little bit around Clive, and I think even a couple pages with Alex Scudder, who ends up being the love interest at the end. But never completely in their heads. The narrator's still detached and gives us some objective point of view, so... But we do get their feelings and emotions. So. Yes,
especially from Maurice.
Especially Maurice, yes. Definitely. Definitely. So who's the protagonist?
Well, to answer your question with a question, what is the title of the book? Maurice!
Yeah, Maury for short.
Maury. Mo?
No
one calls him that.
He does paternity tests and sees if...
Yes.
Yeah, the Maury show?
Yes. He was a pioneer. He went underground because no one could know he was gay and then reemerged as a daytime TV star.
Like 100 years later.
Right.
And turned black somehow.
And reverse aged for a while. Read the sequel! Oh boy.
Oh lord.
Rails? Us.
But Maurice, so as I mentioned, he's fairly average to start out with when he's a kid. He follows convention, he likes his family. He never really tries too hard to, think outside the box, but to think in general, he doesn't.
I think that's a fair statement.
Care too much about that.
He's bad at thinking more than he is uninterested in it.
Yeah, in college, when people are trying to have conversations with him, he'll try to pick a point to argue just so he can be in the conversation, only to have, you know, them point out that he's totally wrong and doesn't even believe what he's saying.
Yep.
Like, what do you really care about? The Trinity. Okay, what do you care about the Trinity? I don't really care about the Trinity.
Three of them.
They all exist at the same time. You don't really care about the Trinity.
Yeah, I guess I don't.
You know, okay, well, I care about the resurrection. You're full of shit.
No, you don't. I do. Okay, I don't.
That's essentially how those conversations go. He's a big, healthy, strong guy.
Yes.
And he's...
He's a rugger man.
Yeah. He takes a while to kind of figure out what his feelings are. I describe him as a big, dumb dork.
He is a big, dumb dork. I said his emotions are on a 3-week delay.
Yeah, I like that that assessment. So when he meets Clive Durham, who's a classmate and is also leaning that way... Clive is a super intellectual kind of snob. He always tries to take conversations to a deep place and show off how well-read and smart he is.
Clive is, a bit of a nerd, really.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, he and Maurice do things like Clive leans against him and Maurice strokes his hair, which you'd think would be obvious enough, but... He also tries to do things like, read Plato's Symposium. And by saying that, he thinks he's, like, gonna give Maurice this huge clue of, this is how I feel about you, because the symposium has references to homosexuality in it. Instead, Maurice reads it, and he's like, I don't get it.
I don't get it.
Why didn't you read that book? I don't know. And then, so Clive, you know, finally admits, actually says, like, straight up, I love you. And Maurice is like,
What's rot?
Yeah, and then, like, that night, he's like, oh, shit. I love him, too.
Yeah, and then...
Maurice, you freaking dork.
Had to feel terrible about it for a while.
Until they can finally come to terms.
Yes. Actually, one of the things that amused me about Maurice was his tendency to fall back on what, like, stereotypical Englishisms.
Yeah.
He did a lot of... I say, man, that kind the kind of, like, movie English gentleman.
Uh-huh.
That was half of his dialogue.
I loved it when the characters talked like that. Thanks terribly. Like, what? Who says that?
I wish everybody said that.
But if, like, an American wrote that was writing this book, people would be like, the British people sound so dumb.
That's probably true. They sound too British.
Yeah, that's not how they really talk. And even Forster's like, I beg to differ.
He's like, this is how they really talk, in my brain.
So the main difference between Clive and Maurice, they're both gay, but while Maurice is really interested in a loving, caring relationship, he, you know, thinks things like, I remember at one point, well, this is a bad time for Clive, and it's hard for us, but I'll take care of him because I know at some point in the future it'll be hard for me and he'll take care of me, which is a very long-term relationship thought. Like, that is what you do for each other.
Yes.
He's really interested in caring and loving and showing that. And Clive is much more, like, the intellectual man, pure manly relationship thing, where you're not really physically showing your love, you're just intellectually connected. And
Clive believed the symposium when he read it.
Yeah. And I mean, Clive, he kind of sounded like, and I know this isn't fair because it was 1913, so, like, anyone who was gay would struggle with it a lot, but he's reminding me of, like, someone who's gay today who's, like, comes from a really super Christian upbringing, like, worrying a ton about how sinful it is, and, like, he can never act on it, and then he acts on it, but he can't bring himself to do any of the physical things.
Right, yeah.
That sort of thing. I thought that that sort of character type is something that happens in real life.
Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely. I can't say I have met someone who is trying as hard to repress it as
he does.
Clive, but I can think of a couple of folks I knew as an undergraduate who were struggling with that, or actually one guy who came out his, like, halfway through his senior year and surprised everybody because no one had any idea. Mm. Though, if he'd acted like Clive, we would have had an idea.
If he'd been leaning against other men's legs and having his hair stroked and...
It's just a very gay thing to do.
Well, you're saying, like, is that his, like, in the past, would just friends do that and we're missing something? Because in the modern day, if you saw two guys doing that, you'd be like, oh, they're dating.
In the modern day, if you see a guy leaning against another guy's legs in the chair, you start to wonder.
Even without the hair stroking.
I'm willing to meet you that far, 1913, but the hair stroking seems like a dead giveaway. To which Ian Forrester just says that undergraduates are not particularly observant.
Which I thought was hilarious. Ben and I were saying before we recorded that we really need to comb through the book and just pull out all the good sentences.
Oh, man, yeah. The way Forrester uses language is really fun.
It's okay to call your cousin a shit, but a eunuch? Bad form.
Bad form.
Something like that.
And for those of you who don't follow our Twitter account, or who don't read it because most weeks we only update it with the post. Maurice had fallen asleep in the Valley of the Shadow and knew not that his schoolfellows were sleeping likewise. Which was Forster's way of telling us that Maurice and all his classmates felt guilty because they were masturbating all the time.
Yeah, what ifs?
Hey, it happens. You're teenagers, man.
One of the reasons you can tell this was written in 1913 is the euphemism.
Yes, indeed.
You're like, okay, wait, was that sex, or do I have to... Okay, yeah. He's baiting. Got it.
Beastly, sorry.
Ruthless, sorry.
Can't talk right now. Fappin.
Oh, God. Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord.
All right, well... They've gotten the two of them out of the way. Let's actually bring in the third leg of the gay man triangle, just because each one of them kind of represents a different approach to being gay, I'd say.
A different type, almost.
Yeah. So Clive's, you know, like the intellectual, struggling with sin, trying to be chaste thing. Maurice, like, doesn't really know what he's feeling or what's going on, if he should feel guilty about it, and he, like, wants to kiss guys, but...
And Alex Scudder is up for some action,
man. Yeah, Alex Scudder just climbs into your window and does you. Yeah. Which I appreciate about him.
Yes.
the other difference, too, is that Alex Scudder is a servant. Although he is fairly well-educated, but he's of a lower class, but that means he's more in touch with his feelings, I guess?
That seems...
Or more blunt about them?
Yeah, I'd say the second one, for sure. And in the case of Clive and Maurice, probably the first one, too. I mean, they're... Maurice is not emotionally stunted, but again, his emotions are just on this weird delay.
Takes him a while to figure things out.
And Clive eventually decides to repress that part of himself, which I feel like his life is not going to be good a couple decades down the road.
Yeah, well, and by all accounts, it sounds like he and his wife never have sex either.
Yeah, that's...
Which is not great.
Not usually a good recipe for a happy marriage.
Yeah.
Alec is... He's blunt. He's... Why didn't you meet me at the boathouse? We were going to meet at the boathouse.
Yeah, apparently, like, his number one fantasy is to, like, have sex in the boathouse. But I just kind of thought was adorable, actually. Why didn't you go? I always fancy doing it in the boathouse.
Like the bone house.
Ayo. But he's really forward. He writes Maurice a couple letters, like, I miss you, why'd you go away? Like, you can't just do that and then not talk to me, yep. Sort of thing. And then he actually goes out of his way to go to London to confront Maurice. And he's kind of trying to do this, like, bluster, blackmail front of, like, you can't ignore me or else I'll tell everyone about you. And then he's like, no, I just like you. And I'm
yeah. Like, I say that front doesn't stay up for very long.
No.
Maurice is like, you're that, but you can't, you're not going to do that. I'm not. I just wanted to see you.
I actually haven't told anybody.
Like,
I just wanted you to come to the boathouse.
Poor Alec.
I was like, you're adorable.
He's like, you just didn't realize that Maurice needed 3 weeks to,
yeah.
to process first. That's how he works, man.
It's cool. He's got it.
They're going to figure that out. That's going to be an inside joke between them someday.
Remember when we slept together and then you didn't know you liked me for like 3 weeks?
Right. It's going to be like 40 years later and it's still going to get brought up. Like 1952.
Damn it, shut up, Alec! You did that and Maurice is going to be like, you want to go to the boathouse?
That'd probably be the comeback.
The retort.
Yes.
So... When
I'm enjoying how much we are enjoying speculating on their adorable future
together. Yeah. Well, Ian Forster said he wanted them to be together forever.
That's true.
So I'm just going to pretend they don't die in the war or any of that. Not that he says they die in the war. I'm just saying the wars are coming up.
Well, yeah. The story takes place in 1912, and I think most of us are fairly aware that Europe, starting in 1914, was not a happy place to live.
Yeah. But if you kind of take that to the, you know, modern day equivalent again, like if Clive is the Christian who's like struggling, then compared Alec to the like.
Oh, the
out city kid who's like totally comfortable with himself and shown him the ropes.
Yeah, the urban gay guy who's welcomed him into the culture, which from all accounts sounds, well, a lot more open than hetero culture, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't speak from first-hand experience.
Or can you?
Or can I?
Were you a gay man in the 1930s?
I said, should we throw in the Seinfeldian tag? Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
No.
I actually don't like that.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think they are implying there's something wrong.
Yeah, it's a little out of date, I would say.
Yeah, so those are like the three big main characters in the book and their different approaches. And we do have some secondary characters as well. Anne, who is married to Clive. She's a polite person.
She seems like a nice girl.
She does.
I should feel a little bad for her.
Like when they're in the when they're in the piano room and it's raining and dripping through the ceiling and she she calls the hole in the ceiling like a dear little hole or something.
Yeah.
And then everyone's making fun of her, like, what is wrong with you?
He's like, oh, the roof is leaking, that's cute. Like, no, that's bad. It's gonna ruin the piano.
And she likes Maurice.
She seems honestly happy to see him. At the very least, she's a good enough hostess that Clive worries that she'll be pissed if they don't give him a room to stay for the night when he shows up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she seems fairly authentic, interested in other people, like a nice person, just mm-hmm. in general. We don't really get too much of her besides that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't get a ton of any of the female characters, really.
Yeah. Her role is more just like, look at this nice girl that Clive married.
Right.
You know, this good gentry wedding that's supposed to happen.
It fits the mold of what he's trying to do, because he's trying now to run for office and be the, yeah, you know, be the gentry. Mm-hmm. And she's the kind of the archetypical wife for mm-hmm. that person.
Yeah. Yep.
Helping with the organizing, being a great hostess.
She feels sympathy for the poor.
She does, yeah. Actually, that was that scene was kind of amusing. She's like, well, what do you think about the poor? And all the men who are out making money are like, the poor.
Snarf, snarf.
And kind of, yes, snarf, snarf, snarf. And the narrator implies this is the proper attitude for these kind of men, while at the same time kind of implying that maybe they should listen to her.
Yeah. Her and the pastor are like, hey, that's rude.
Come on, guys.
Other female characters, we have Maurice's sisters, Kitty and Ava. Apparently Kitty is kind of smart and talks back to people, but we don't get that much from her.
She talks back to people, but I was actually under the impression she wasn't that smart.
Hmm.
I don't know. I kept associating her with Kitty Bennett.
Oh.
Yeah. Kept with better impulse control, I guess.
Yeah. Well. And then Ava is Maurice's kind-hearted, buxom sister.
Yes. She was the pretty one.
Yeah. That's... Oh, no, I did like the mention that when Maurice's grandfather dies, he gives all his money to Ava because she's his favorite grandkid.
Right.
Like, he doesn't even try. It's like, whatever, I like her the best.
Here's all
Here
the money.
Here you go. I'm gonna go live in the sun now.
Oh, yeah, I was gonna say, that was a moment that I forgot to put on our list earlier. Him and his... And not really that weird by historical standards, I guess, but weird by England 1913 sun worship.
Yep.
All the souls go to the sun. Of course they do, Granddad.
What?
Yeah, you just have a nice rest.
And then we have Risley, who is one of Maurice's classmates, and I basically put him on the list because Ben liked him.
He's
not terribly important.
No, he's not that important. I guess he is kind of indirectly responsible for Clive and Maurice meeting.
Yeah.
But Risley shows up at a dinner with the dean, and he's basically a vulgar loudmouth who doesn't give a damn what anyone thinks.
Yep.
So I liked him.
That's exactly how he works.
And then he showed up again briefly later and was basically the same character.
Yeah.
For about a page, and then was gone again.
I was surprised he didn't play a bigger role after he was introduced. Because I thought he was going to end up being some kind of love interest for Maurice, maybe.
I did, too. I thought the loudmouth guy was going to help break him out of his intellectual shell by his being like, just say what you think. Who gives a shit?
Yeah. But not to be.
No. He wasn't even hanging out with he and Clive and the other guys ever, it sounded like.
No, I know. He's just... Every once in a while, someone would be like, yeah, Risley.
Risley was the club guy, from the sounds of things. Or whatever the equivalent was, because he was always gone until, like, dawn.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he's going to bathhouses.
Maybe.
Or whatever.
Maybe.
I don't know. I got the impression Risley could be gay.
I...
And not give a shit.
Was pretty under the impression that he was, in fact, gay.
Yeah. And we included the two doctors on the list mostly because Maurice, when he goes through his period of loneliness and then decides he's going to cure himself unsuccessfully, he goes and visits two different doctors to try and get it done. And Dr. Barry's the first one, and he's a family friend of theirs who he's known in pretty much his entire life, so he thinks maybe he can trust him to give him some good advice.
Yeah, and he's kind of an entertaining character. He's kind of a cranky old bastard, but then he always gets around to dispensing his advice, which I never agree with, but he kind of misinterprets Maurice's concerns, and then when Maurice tries to make it more obvious what he's thinking, he just says, "That's ridiculous." And that was the end of the conversation. Yeah. He wasn't even offended by the idea. He's just like, oh.
Just never talk about that.
Guys get confused and think they might be curious about that, but they're just silly.
Yeah, first he thinks he, like, has an STD.
Right.
It's like, where'd you get it? Let me look at your junk.
Let's see the junk. Junk looks great, man. Go have kids. But I don't want to have sex with women. Ridiculous.
Basically.
But I'm really conflicted. I don't feel good. So he sees a hypnotist, and that doesn't work.
Yeah, Lasker Jones. Yeah. Surprisingly. And Maurice even mentions, like, he throws hypnotism into the same lot as, like, what was it? Seances or something like that? Like, just stupid nonsense.
Gotta try something.
Basically what it is. The one thing I did really like about Lasker Jones, though, even though his hypnotism didn't work, is he was just so straightforward about it and, like, wasn't judgy. He was just like, well, I'll do what I can, like, willing to talk about it. And then when it didn't really seem to work, he basically just said, go somewhere where you can be gay and, like, won't get in trouble for it.
Yeah, essentially. He was, he seemed to be finding their last appointment somewhat distasteful, but I don't know if that was just because he was fed up with Maurice's whining or what.
Well, it mentioned that he didn't really like fellows of that sort, but then he also said that he was bored.
Yeah, yeah, that was, seemed to be more the thing to
me. Yeah, so.
All right, well, let's see, we've kind of touched on a couple of the issues here already.
Yeah.
We talked about women characters and basically not being three-dimensional.
Yeah, not very many of them. None of them get a big role because it's about guys.
Right. Sexual issues, well...
Obviously. I
mean, obviously.
Yeah, we talked about that, like, you know, should it be physical or not? Is it a sin or not? Is it natural or unnatural?
There was a really good line about that as well, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was along the lines of, it seems to me that natural is what a person is, what a person considers natural is what they're comfortable with, which I really liked, because you hear, I almost don't even want to say opponents of homosexuality, because... It's, to me, it's just not like an issue where there's a rational argument and counter argument. There is a group of people, and then there are people who are either confused or hateful and don't like them. But they like to use the word unnatural, and I think that's probably exactly the case. Gay sex, it's weird, I don't want to think about it, it's unnatural. It's unnatural because you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't read a book either. It doesn't make it unnatural.
Oh, snap. Certainly would never read Maurice.
Yeah, that's true. Not for very long, anyway.
And one of the awesome things about the book, like we mentioned, it's written 100 years ago, and the author basically seems to come to the decision that, yeah, being gay, that's natural enough. You should just go off and...
Love who you love, man.
Yeah, and that Maurice, for a while, is, like, freaking out because he's trying to convince himself it's all lust. But then, you know, the author is careful to point out that they're actually in love.
Right.
They're not just having sex.
Right.
So, you know, he authentically believes that two people can be in a loving same-sex relationship.
Yes. Though to concept. Though to do so, they must be atheists.
Yeah, so that ties into the religious issues. In addition to most of the people who defend religion don't actually care that much about it in the book.
True.
Maurice, at first, trying to defend the religion, basically becomes atheist within weeks.
Yes. Clive's mother is... They have a big argument over one of the vacations because he won't take communion because he's an atheist now. And she's not mad at him for not believing. She's mad at him for not letting the people of the county watch him go up to the altar like they usually watch the family go up to the altar.
Yeah, it's all about status, not about religion.
Indeed.
And Forrester basically seems to say that if you're gay, you have to be an atheist. I feel like he almost flat out says it at one point.
I think he did even flat out say it at one point. And sometimes, I've heard people voice thoughts like that today. Modern, mm-hmm. Not today, today, but in the modern day.
Today!
Earlier today! And it does seem a little weird sometimes when you hear about a gay person who is also a Christian, just because so much of their opposition comes from Christianity, mm-hmm. but I always have to I myself, as an atheist, have to remind myself that the vast majority of Christians are actually very pleasant and accepting and loving people.
Douchey assholes.
And not the asshole who's shouting at the top of his lungs on television.
Yeah. But definitely in 1913, I think it'd be a lot harder to be openly gay and accepting, or not, maybe not openly gay, but accepting of your sexuality and religious when the church is...
I think orthodoxy was a lot more important. I think there were different sects of Protestantism in America. In England, it's largely been the one church, I think, still.
Anglicans.
From what I know. But it's like the liberal versus the conservative congregations probably existed to some degree, but I think the line was a lot firmer. And certainly the Anglicans have always been pretty closely aligned with Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Just reporting to a different officer, I guess.
Yeah, basically. Henry VIII instead of the Pope.
Yes.
Oh, wait a minute. And then just... Like I was saying, religion in general in the book is never taken super, super seriously.
Right.
Like, most of the characters don't care too much about it, and it's more just a matter of following form than actually believing.
It's a lot of lip service.
Yeah.
And even the pastor was... He seemed like a decent enough fellow.
Uh-huh.
But, actually, in the afterword, Forster specifically said, in the end, wasn't bright enough to catch on to what Maurice was feeling.
Yeah.
Even though he had ample opportunity to do so.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of rolls into it as well.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, so as we were saying, and we've already basically covered the themes, but love is good.
Love is good.
And so on the flip side, being gay is not bad.
Right.
Which for a 100-year-old book, it just is still kind of blowing my mind.
I know. I did not... I mean, logically, it seems that there should have been a percentage of people who believed that.
Uh-huh.
But you certainly don't associate 100 years ago with an open acceptance of homosexuality.
Yeah.
Especially because in 2013, we're still struggling with it. It's pretty... It's pretty ahead of its time. I mean, to try to put that in print, even, as well.
I did like the point that Forster made, and I think it was in his afterword. It was kind of a downer, because he was saying, I thought the open and acceptance would happen, but instead people are just hostile toward it.
Mm-hmm.
But then he made the point that he thought if all of the legalities and acceptance kind of happened behind closed doors and were footnotes instead of headlines, that people will be totally cool with it. But because it's been blown up into this huge deal, then people are getting all bent out of shape. And he's like, if the parliament legalized all that stuff, but then it was just, like, at the bottom of a newspaper article and was one line, then no one would really care.
Right. Because it doesn't affect people in their everyday life.
Yeah, they just care because they have to think about it.
Exactly.
That was an interesting point.
Well, and it kind of fits in with the idea of naturalness and what you're comfortable with, mm-hmm. too. If you have to think about it, it upsets you. If you don't, then it doesn't. Let's see. The convention is not necessarily a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty constant theme. Because Clive, when he falls back on being mannerly and following convention and orthodoxy, he kind of starts ignoring who he is and leaves Maurice. And mm-hmm. the harder Maurice tries to be conventional, the more miserable he mm-hmm. ends up being.
Yep. And the conventional people are looking down on not just, like, people who are different than them, but, like, you know, treat the servants like shit, because that's what you do.
Right, yeah.
Or...
I mean, the conventional people are boors, basically.
Yeah, yeah. They're not very likable, and you're not really supposed to look up to them. Yes. And, yeah. Okay, let's see here. Oh, yeah. So, the other thing we did want to mention about the book is all the references to gay culture. That are kind of done obliquely.
Yeah, they're ones you would get if you were educated, for sure.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we've mentioned the symposium. We've mentioned, I think, Oscar Wilde. Oh, you mean in an Oscar Wilde way.
Yeah, and everyone knows what that means, because
right.
Oscar Wilde was famously put in jail for being gay,
and what was
bizarre.
What was the flip side to Hellenistic that they kept using? They kept describing people as one of a couple of ways, and Hellenistic was obviously gay-leaning.
Yeah, I don't remember the flip. Hellenistic is referring to Greeks, or Alexander the Great is basically credited with creating, like, the Hellenistic culture.
Right.
And Alexander the Great was maybe not gay, but definitely slept with men.
Well-known dalliances with men.
Yeah, and several of his generals did as well.
Yeah.
So people kind of associate that with that way.
Right.
The Greek vice.
Yes. And I was obsessed briefly for a chapter or two with Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. The Pathetic Symphony, as they kept calling it in the book. That's actually when Maurice met Clive, he was trying to sort out the pianola parts for the Pathetic Symphony,
mm-hmm.
which we now usually refer to as the Symphonie Pathétique.
Yeah, the French version.
Yes, the French language version of the Russian Symphony. but Tchaikovsky, I, a couple pages later, realized, oh wait, Tchaikovsky is pretty well known to be gay. I mean, how can you write Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies and be heterosexual?
Oh, whatever.
Yeah. the title is the giveaway, come on. But nothing to do with the play on the word fairies. It's just such a goddamn cute song. It should have been written by a 6-year-old. Not sexual at all. Anyway, and then a couple pages after I had that realization, they referred to his biography and his publicized breakup with his wife and
mm-hmm.
going to have relationships with men.
Yep. So all these references that let you know. And they actually, the hypnotist doctor straight up just says homosexuality at one point.
That's true. I think he's the only person who says the word, too.
It surprised me.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I wasn't sure if they had that word yet.
Yeah, me neither, actually.
I guess they did.
They actually, Alec at one point says, fuck. And I said, oh, hey, Alec, people used fuck.
It was around. Good to know.
Yeah.
Good to know that they'd figured out fuck.
Oh, Lord. Anything else you would like to say before we move on?
Well, I'm staggered that we got this far in the episode before one of us tried on a horrible British accent.
Oh, God. Eh, I didn't think about that. I'm not going to try one.
I think I've done my allotted amount for this whole year, probably.
Oh, I did want to mention British slang for being super tired is being fagged.
Yes.
Which is kind of funny since they're all gay.
Yeah, right. Wait, was that? Oh no,
fagged.
He's just tired.
Oh,
wait, was that one? Oh no, he's just tired too.
He's just tired. Okay, moving on. So, strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Very clever use of language. As we mentioned, there were a couple of turns of phrase that we enjoyed.
Yeah, some good quotes. Occasionally. Conversations got a little confusing. I would go, did those pieces of dialogue relate to each other at all? But I guess they did. But that wasn't, like, a pervasive problem. It was actually pretty easy to read.
Yeah, it was, even though as far as action event sort of thing happening, not much happened.
Yeah, very little. It never drags, but it's never, like, a crazy heart-pounding race or anything.
Yeah, it was the rare more introspective novel that was easy to read. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of those, even good ones, a lot of times get bogged down.
Yeah, if this had been 50 pages longer, it would be too long.
Yeah, and if it had been 100 pages longer, it would have been so far up its own ass that it would have been unreadable, probably.
More stuff would have had to happen, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and like we mentioned, it's just surprisingly relevant in the modern day for something that was written a long time ago. So I guess questions. You were questioned, Ben.
Oh, yeah, I was wondering if, 20 years down the road, if middle-aged Clive would be having a series of affairs with other men when his repression finally broke loose, because I've certainly heard my share of stories about middle-aged closeted men finally coming out or not coming out, but finally not being able to take the pressure anymore and going nuts.
Yeah. I think you could read Clive's character as authentically
platonic,
becoming straight, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more tempting to read him as being super repressed, especially since he was always having problems with being repressed, even when he was
Certainly as a 21st century reader, that's immediately what you go to.
Plus the fact that he and his wife, like, don't really have a physical relationship.
It's kind of weird. I'm just saying, most people who like having sex with women and are married to one, go ahead and have sex with women. Specifically that woman.
Just
in general. They take advantage of that opportunity.
Well, that's the very wise words of my fiancé giving advice to one of his friends who wanted to have more sex was, get a girlfriend and then you can have sex all the time.
Get a girlfriend who likes having sex, man. That's the easiest.
It's way easier than trying to pick up chicks.
Yeah, and safer.
Yeah, well, and healthier.
And satisfying. And yeah.
Many, many things.
There's basically no downside.
Yeah. But it's true, like, you want to have sex? Then go get a girlfriend. So your verdict, where did that come from?
My verdict, both of those things, is good.
Good.
I liked it.
I liked it, too.
It was good.
Yeah, I'd recommend, it's a little hard to find, like we said, our library system only had one copy, and it was in Gardner, which is a ways from us. I had bought a copy off Amazon a while ago, so that's why we're a day late, because we had to share it.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth reading, especially if you're interested in, you know, books up with featuring gay relationships, positive ones, too.
Yeah, a like, good representation of one, and one that isn't a romance novel, I guess, as well.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely doesn't fall into the romance novel tropes.
Now, that's where I really want to throw in that. Not that there's anything wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the romance novel, but it's, you know, it's a different type of literature, I think.
That's why we didn't call this a gay romance. Mm-hmm. I've read a couple of those, and they're basically just excuses to describe graphic guy-on-guy action.
Right. It's more like 50 Shades of Grey, but, you know, not despicable.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord.
So
what are you reading right now?
I am reading a book called Hate List by Jennifer Brown. I think I mentioned last time I was reading a book that involved school shooting, and this one also does. Told from the point of view of the girlfriend of the guy who did the shooting and the aftermath of it. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's a little different spin. I am just reading the next book that we're podcasting. So we might as well tell you what that is right now. It's Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn.
The hit sensation. I think tons of people were reading it fairly recently. We're getting on board a little late.
Yeah.
But apparently tons of people fucking love this book.
Interesting.
So we're giving it a shot.
We will see if we love this book. It has siblings in it who are close. I approve of that.
Yeah. And he even mentions at one point that people think they're too close.
I tweeted about that, too.
Yeah. Go check out our Twitter feed or retweet us if you'd like to. You can find Sagui. Us. You can find us at Novel Ideas Pod.
Yes, or you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can shoot us an email at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
And we're still on iTunes.
We are still on
iTunes. They haven't kicked us off yet.
We still don't know how to make a banner up here or there, but yes. Damn it, we're trying.
And I'm just going to throw this out for a couple of episodes, because I think not everybody listens to every single one, but... if you like to download the episode directly and you're not an iTunes user, please get in touch with me. I want to know if you exist. Because if I don't know that you exist, I'm not going to do anything about it.
Yeah, we want to know if not being able to download directly from the website is throwing a kink in your groove.
And there may be a way to do it, I just haven't. It's not the default option anymore, so WordPress is tricksy sometimes.
It's a tricksy hobbit.
Indeed. So anyway, I think
that's it.
We'll do it. Yeah. Yeah. It was fun.
Yeah.
I liked it. So we'll see you next time.
At the boathouse.
We'll see you at the boathouse.